This is Inspired, where we explore the beliefs shaping our world. I'm your host, Amber Khan. Both David Robinson and Mansfield Caseman see the role of a religious leader as key to protecting the public. But not all congregations are created equal, nor are the challenges they face, like having access to running water. In the heart of LA, in a crowded urban district not far from the Staples Center, you will find Reverend Mandy Sloan McDowell, setting up tents on Sundays.
My first Sunday, we moved outdoors. We set up tents in our parking lot. We hold our worship services very publicly, with literally no walls, no doors, no boundaries. And it has been an unbelievable blessing that has really revitalized the congregation.
Reverend McDowell pastors the Los Angeles First Methodist Congregation, known as a church without walls. It was a job she wanted.
I asked to come and serve this church because it seemed like such a unique and beautiful challenge.
I reached out to Reverend McDowell to learn about how she is responding to the coronavirus. But first, she gave me some history about their location. Los Angeles First Methodist was founded in 1853 by a Missouri preacher named Adam Bland, who set up his pulpit in a downtown LA saloon. His mission?
To evangelize the rowdy and incorrigible Southland that was starting to root and grow in the Southern California area. So he showed up in the 1850s and started preaching in a bar.
Bland's effort to reach the rowdy and the incorrigible was a success. Church membership reached 6,000 at its peak in the early 20th century. But as cities changed, members moved away, and the congregation dwindled and aged. In the 1990s, the church gave up its building and now meets in a parking lot, she explains.
We have a pod on site. It holds all of our tents. I think we're up to 8 now. So we keep adding tents, which is a good sign that we're growing. So we see people who will come and witness and observe and watch and take it in, even if they don't stay for the entire service. And I think that that's just a real gift. And we also have a lot of houseless people who will come and just, you know, they'll come and stay for the food, for the coffee. They'll take what they need. They'll sit down and rest while they can. And, you know, we may or may not see them week to week, but sometimes we do. And we've been able to develop some really meaningful relationships there to help understand how we can help our neighbors.
She sees the absence of walls as a reflection of her calling.
It's one of the blessings of this situation is we joke that we don't have any sacred cows because they were already torn down. When we say that the church has open hearts, open minds, open doors, that's been the slogan of the Methodist Church for many years. My church can actually model that. And when we say that we're open to all people, we literally are. And I can't imagine ever having to go back into a building, truly.
You mentioned that given the population of your community that come from different places within the housed, as you described, and those who are unhoused. And I'm struck by that language. You're not referring to individuals who live outside of homes as homeless. You're calling them unhoused.
The call of the gospel is to love God and love our neighbor. Not all of our neighbors have permanent addresses, but they're still our neighbors. Calling them homeless people, that diminishes their humanity, and it reduces them to an aspect of their circumstance that they have not chosen. And nor is it a key part of their identity that they see.
Could you speak to how your community is responding right now to the coronavirus epidemic or what the World Health Organization is now describing as a pandemic?
So for the last 2 weeks, we've been sharing information directly from the World Health Organization, trusting that they are putting out positive information that is helpful. They have very clear instructions on how to wash hands. One of the things I really appreciate is that the WHO has put out information on how to manage stress and anxiety. And I see that as just a genuine offer of pastoral care, that they are recognizing that this is really stressful. And especially people who are unhoused are really concerned because they're so vulnerable and so exposed.
Could you talk about kind of the diversity of the congregants that you have that attend service and how some of them have been supporting those who may have more limited resources and limited access to healthcare or health information?
It's a blessing that we do have a true diversity in pretty much every possible way, in age, in socioeconomic status, in educational levels, gender identity, all of it. We have some older members who are very thoughtful about how they can help. And because they are in pretty stable housing and financial situations, they've been very generous. So once a month, we do something called Blessing Bags, and we've been doing this since 2017. We collect supplies tailored to the circumstance. And this month, we're collecting supplies from our members. We're aiming for soap. We're trying to make sure that we have individually wrapped things that can be, you know, even though it's not great for the environment, but they can be disposed of when used, that everyone has access to the hygiene things that they need. And remarkably, we've seen our millennial members have been the most thoughtful and the most caring because they're so well informed. They want everyone to know what they know. And they've been wonderful to highlight certain aspects of how people can be caring for one another.
And that that kind of working together, I'm curious how you see congregants. Are they communicating with you around their fears, their anxiety, and around who they trust in terms of where they get their information?
That's a really good question, because churches in general are places that usually have to work very hard to earn people's trust. For our older members, we have encouraged them to stay home. We sent out an email last week encouraging our population to stay home and worship with us via our online streaming platform. Every Sunday, we stream to a social media site. And that has been a wonderful way for us to just expand our message, to reach more people. We try to present information in a kind and thoughtful way to say that there are a variety of ways that we can address these things and manage them on our own. And we encourage you to do it in the way that you see fit, without judgment.
You talked about the streaming services. We're seeing a lot of that and hearing from lots of different faith communities in different religious traditions, leaning on technology. Sometimes new platforms that are streaming sermons or information can be difficult to navigate if you're not native to it, if it's not something you're really comfortable and fluent in. Are you putting together tutorials? Are you doing 101s of this is how you access the sermon?
Because we've been doing it for 2.5 years, we tend to have members who are comfortable with technology and have access to it. But that's not the case in every church. I've served plenty of churches where older members were not as savvy technologically. What this is doing is really highlighting that this is not just about invisible members. This is about real, vital, active people who are really having to think hard about how to take care of themselves. And so it's forcing, I would say, it's forcing faith communities to take seriously their relationship with people who are not able to be physically present. What are we really actively doing to engage the people who are unable to be physically present? And that's just a good question for every faith community to take seriously, because now is the time where we're going to have to be really thoughtful. We cannot expect people to come to us right now, and we're going to have to go to them in ways that are safe and responsible.
And isolation is something that you mentioned earlier that can often provoke anxiety and a level of discomfort. What are some of the recommendations that you're offering to your congregation on how to cope with isolation?
Well, that's a good question. It's make use of the technology we do have. Most people are comfortable with the telephone and can make a phone call just to check in on their neighbor.
Are you communicating what you see or needs that are unmet? For example, you talked about access to running water for the unhoused in some of the encampments near where your church meets. Are you communicating that back to your local or regional governments that are responsible for thinking about resources to the most vulnerable as a means of, you know, preventing the spread of the COVID-19 coronavirus?
We know that that is something that we need to be engaging. We have just recently had a city council election. We have somebody new coming into the office, which is wonderful. So one of the things that comes first is having relationships with the city officials and with the government. And then, of course, once you have those relationships, it's much easier to share feedback. We're working with our denominational body, so with our regional annual conference, to address some of the challenges that we see. And then with our neighborhood South Park Business Improvement District to say, we see that this is a real crisis. What are some of the solutions that we can provide, especially for those who don't have access?
How much of your time do you feel being now called to being that connector, communicator, amplifying the things that you're seeing in your congregation to your neighborhood advocates or to your city council advocates or the emergency and health preparation folks works? How much time are you dedicating to it? And how much of a priority is it for you right now?
It's taking up a lot of brain power and prayer. Most of our prayers right now are dedicated to understanding how we can keep one another safe and to be respectful and dignified about how we keep ourselves safe and how we look after everybody else. I don't think I've had a conversation in the last 2 weeks that didn't include something serious about what we are doing and what we need to be doing.
Are you revisiting scripture? Are you looking at news stories, particularly from the Judeo-Christian tradition?
Well, there's so much rich material in the Gospels about Jesus' engagement with marginalized people, with those who were outcast and cast aside, forgotten, ignored, overlooked, invisible. Yeah. And yes, looking at those texts again right now is so helpful because the first thing that happens in every one of those texts is that Jesus sees the person, not for their disability, not for their illness, sees them for who they are. And even if we're still being safe and careful and cautious, the first thing we do is to see one another.
We've seen an increase in public health being politicized with contradictory messages about whether or not the coronavirus is in fact a legitimate public health crisis. I've been struck by some of the things that I'm seeing from folks in the faith community encountering an attitude in which even the notion or message that we need public health prevention, like not handshaking, is being treated as a political message as opposed to a public health message.
I've been seeing the same things where people are, you know, cavalierly handshaking in the face of encouragement not to do so as a statement. And that's really hard to see how publicly some of the responses have been in the face of the science. I trust that the experts know what they're doing. The Christian faith is one that is predicated on politics. I last week got into a political discussion with a former congregant who I love dearly, and we see things differently. And that's one of the beauties of any faith tradition is that we can be both faithful and still disagree about the ramifications of that. And this is not about who is right or wrong. But her comment to me was, pastors should just stick to preaching the gospel and stay out of politics. And my gentle, I hope, loving response to her was, Jesus was crucified for a political crime. Our faith is deeply entrenched in politics. So we cannot pretend that, you know, we can't render under Caesar what is Caesar's when that is the call. There are some things that we have to do to engage politics. Our faith is inherently political.
It almost feels like your answer is that when faith leaders see the politicizing of public health messages that potentially put our neighbors at risk, as you understand it through a theological lens, that faith leaders have an obligation to speak out.
So I think it's important for faith leaders to speak out because someone else is going to. And they might say something that's really hurtful or contradictory. So for all of us who are trying to say, please, let's take this seriously, let's be thoughtful, let's be careful, and let's be mindful of our neighbors. And sometimes that's going to mean, you know, keeping to ourselves a little bit, changing our practices, adapting how we share communion, adapting how we greet each other. And if our call always is to err on the side of love. And the problem is right now we'll see people erring on the side of, well, arrogance.
Reverend Mandy Sloan McDowell is the pastor of the Los Angeles First Methodist Church in Los Angeles, California. As more cases are confirmed and quarantines imposed, stress and anxiety levels are on the rise. How are you coping? Leave us a message at 202-885-6567. We want to hear from you. Next week, we'll be featuring counsel and insights on the ways to reduce stress and would love to include your comments and questions. We would like to leave you with a story David Robinson shared with me at the end of our interview. While pandemic-scale events take a toll on families and communities, they can sometimes act as a catalyst for understanding.
In Sierra Leone, after the Ebola crisis, one of the things that emerged was a story from Aisha, who was the principal of the girls' high school in Boo, said, when the messages came across over the radio, we didn't really know what to think, and we didn't trust the government messaging on this. But when the faith leaders began to tell us more and to preach about this in the mosques and the churches and began to build the trust in the messages and where we didn't have to be afraid so much of this virus, knowing how to manage it and control it, it really began to change our whole approach. After the Ebola crisis, we did a debrief, and she said, we didn't know each other before. We didn't really talk about the things of life and death between our communities. Now we do. There are things we can do together we had not thought of before. And one of those, Aisha really wanted Christians and Muslims to work on together, was girls' literacy, because most of the girls of that part of that country were being married off at the moment of puberty, and they never finished school. She said the most important thing for the welfare of our vulnerable children and vulnerable girls is going to be female literacy.
Absolutely.
And she said we would not have known each other and trusted each other as well to deal with this very controversial matter of delaying early marriage so girls can get literate. And that was a fascinating conversation. Building peace between people who don't understand and trust and respect each other, that's a silver lining in a public health emergency like this.
That's all for this week. Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices, relies on the generosity of our supporters. Visit our website, interfaithradio.org, to learn more about us, access our archive of episodes, and sign up for our newsletter. And if you enjoyed this episode, I want to ask you to take a second and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. Visit our website at www.interfaithradio.org to learn more about us. Find our archive of past episodes and sign up for our newsletter. This week's episode was produced by Kevin McCarthy and Kimberly Winston. We are taped at the WAMU studios in Washington, D.C. We are grateful to our founder, Maureen Fiedler, and MC Yogi for our theme music. Stay safe, and we'll see you next week. I'm your host, Amber Khan.